in chief?
I have, Judge.
Great. Would you like to reserve a portion of your 15 minutes for rebuttal?
I would like to reserve 5 minutes if I may.
You have it, and you may proceed when you're ready.
Hey, please, the court. The case I'm here today on is Lamont Woods versus the Commonwealth. I represent Lamont Woods. This case, from start to finish, was just an absolute tragedy. There was a shooting involved. He was charged with first-degree murder, found guilty of second-degree murder, and then following the shooting, there was a tragic car accident en route to the hospital, which killed all of the occupants of the vehicle. What that does for our purposes here today, for purposes of trial, it limited the evidence that was available. The issue that we have today, whether the jury instruction for voluntary manslaughter should have been given, there is, I think, enough evidence that reaches beyond a mere scintilla of evidence in this case that certainly should allow that jury instruction to have been given. I think the appropriate case that the...
Can I ask you about that? And I'm sorry to interrupt you so early on, but as you know, the time goes by really fast here. I know Mr. Woods's testimony was, you know, I was really afraid of this guy, and I was behind the tree, and I came out, and I was actually running away from the vehicle back toward the woods. But the evidence is, and he doesn't contradict this in his testimony, was that 10 shots went off, and all 10 ended up in the victim. And he says, I really wasn't aiming carefully, and I was running away when I did this. And the victim, we have testimony from Dacha that the victim was shot a couple times. There were a couple shots that went off through the rear window of the car. And then the rest of the shots were through the rear passenger window. And then the rest were through the back windshield of the car. And apparently, even though he's slumped down at that point, all of those shots found their way into the victim. So even if he was afraid to begin with, and this is not a submachine gun or something, he has to pull the trigger every time that those 10 shots goes off. How can that not be malice by the time he's finishing filling up his body with gunshots?
Well, a couple of things I'll speak to there, Judge. The Mr. Fitzgerald, the lone witness beyond the appellant in this case, I would suggest in general is incredible. Number one, he admitted at preliminary hearing giving a completely different statement on several salient facts, and moreover admitted that he had a bias toward the appellant on cross-examination for me for killing, for what he says, killing his girlfriend at the time, who was the occupant of the vehicle. Beyond that, Judge, when you have heat of passion and a reasonable provocation, which are required by voluntary manslaughter, that is actually in relation to the provocation. The heat of passion is in relation to the provocation. The case law supports that. And I would suggest that, Judge, it's...
Well, let me ask you this, though. How do you explain the 10 shots all meeting their mark? If at the beginning there's heat of passion, but one would have to aim very carefully and continue to follow where the victim has slumped to continue getting each of those shots into the body of the victim.
You would, Judge, and I would say that there should not be a bright line rule on how many shots is, you know, justifiable in that situation, or that's probably a poor word, but in terms of heat of passion, how many shots is proper. The evidence that we have is that Mr. Lamar Ward, who was the victim, clearly had a terrible reputation for violence. And on top of that, I mean, that was supported by every witness that we had. Even Mr. Fitzgerald, who was in the vehicle, said he never knew Mr. Ward not to carry a gun. I would suggest that in the mind of the appellant in this case, you can certainly see where he was just absolutely trying to make sure that Mr. Ward was not going to come back with that gun, which even Mr. Fitzgerald admits that he saw him reach for it. I saw him reach down to the right side where he normally kept his gun. That being the case, although on the outset, when you look at it, 10 shots inside the body does seem significant, I think it would be problematic to put a specific number of bullets to say this is heat of passion or this is not, because we did not know it was in the mind.
Can heat of passion, though, not turn into malice?
It can, Your Honor. It can. But again, in this case, we're basically asking whether there's enough evidence for a jury instruction. We're not asking whether it was absolutely voluntary manslaughter or not, simply whether the jury should have had an opportunity to hear that as a potential remedy for this situation.
Was there testimony about over what period of time the 10 rounds were fired?
The only testimony that was specific was that it was quick. Mr. Woods testified that he did it in running past the vehicle. Mr. Fitzgerald obviously said it a little differently, that he sort of more calculatedly shot that, but it was, by all indications, it was quick. It was not, it was not drawn out by any measure. All the evidence at the scene showed that after the incident, they sped away, and everything happened in a short time period.
You have these case law, Vaughn and Brandow versus Commonwealth, that talks about if someone testifies, as appellant does here, that, well, I wasn't really even aiming, and I was just so afraid and scared, and I was actually running away when I was shooting, and the actual physical evidence would indicate otherwise. Don't those cases indicate that a jury instruction does not have to be given if the physical evidence completely contradicts what appellant's testimony was? Even though, of course, you look at the evidence in the light most favorable to appellant.
Sure, and they can, Your Honor, but in this case, again, with the limited evidence and limited actual eyewitness testimony that we have in this case, I do think in this case it would be premature to do that, given that again, we really don't know exactly how things did go down there. I mean, the things that we do absolutely know is that Mr. Ward, who was an occupant of that vehicle, showed up at Mr. Woods' home, unknowing to Mr. Woods that he would absolutely be there. He's there, and there's testimony that, and understanding that he was having a relationship with Mr. Woods' ex-girlfriend, and that Mr. Ward had sent text messages the night before to harass him, and did in fact show up with a handgun. I think all of those factors allow us, again, with the limited witness testimony that we have, to be able to say that there could be at least more than a scintilla of evidence here that a voluntary manslaughter instruction should have been given. And Judge, beyond that, I think the Turner case is certainly on point here. I think, number one, with that there certainly was an error in not giving this instruction. The second issue, Judge, we go to is whether that error was harmless or not. And I think it's clear that you can distinguish the Turner case from Mr. Woods' case. In the Turner case, he was charged with first-degree murder. He was found guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced to life. In Mr. Woods' case, he was charged with first-degree murder, found guilty of second-degree murder, and beyond that, was only given 12 years, which is closer to the low end of the range provided for second-degree murder.
That's true, but the jury also found him guilty of maliciously shooting into an occupied vehicle, so wouldn't they have had to have found malice there?
They certainly did find malice in this case. Again, the goal here is not to show that voluntary manslaughter would have been absolutely found. It's just that, again, was there evidence enough for this instruction? Because without that instruction, you're basically usurping the jury's role. I mean, that the Sixth Amendment guarantees that right. And I think that's why we have the rulings that we have previous, where in a jury instruction case, it's looked at in the light most favorable to the appellant or the proponent of that instruction for that reason.
Counsel, can you summarize a little bit why you don't believe it's harmless error in this instance, if it was error at all?
Judge, I do not believe it's harmless, because I think just simply looking at the fact that they found second-degree murder when he was charged first shows that he easily could have been found of something even lesser than that. He could have been found guilty of voluntary manslaughter. And again, with the amount of time that he was given, just 12 years, for that second degree murder charge, I think that also shows the mentality of the jury that they could have gone elsewhere if they had had the tools to do so.
Okay, I get that, but is there any specific evidence in the record that, that you could point to?
In terms of harmful for the instruction, I would just suggest that, I believe the evidence is, again, with the lack of witnesses that we have, there's enough there that there could have been voluntary manslaughter, and as such, there was harm.
Just want to make sure I know you're harmless.
Just want to let you know you're going into your rebuttal time, but please answer Judge Atlee's
question.
Basically,
given that the jury didn't completely abandon already a lesser-included offense, that they should have had the option of another lesser-included offense, and that's at least maybe an inarticulate summary of why you think that this is not harmless.
That is correct, Judge. And again, I think it's salient, the amount of time they gave, because again, that in the Turner case, that they charged first degree, they found first degree and gave him life. In this case, it is distinguished in that charged first degree, found second degree. Could he have been found guilty of a lesser charge? We don't know. And I think there's enough evidence, at least above a scintilla, that instruction should have been given.
Thank you. Mr. Chandeville.
Your Honors, may it please the Court, for Chandeville of the Commonwealth. As been alluded to already, the undisputed physical evidence in this case proved that Mr. Woods fired 10 total shots at the victim, that all 10 shots hit the victim, and also that 8 of those 10 shots struck the victim in the back of the victim's body. Now, on appeal, Mr. Woods is arguing that he's entitled to an instruction on manslaughter because there may have been evidence to prove that he was reasonably provoked by fear or by rage. And of course, the two major problems with that argument, as I've asserted on brief, are first of all, that the undisputed physical evidence disproves any claim that he was reasonably provoked by fear or rage. And secondly, that the jury necessarily rejected the factual basis upon which it might have found that he acted unlawfully and not maliciously when he fired those shots, when the jury found him guilty of maliciously shooting at an occupied vehicle. Now, it's important to note on that second argument, the harmless error argument, the jury was given an instruction that told the jury, if you find that he has unlawfully fired these shots at the vehicle and not maliciously fired the shots at the vehicle, then you can find him guilty of unlawfully shooting at an occupied vehicle. That jury instruction is on page 257 of the appendix. Moreover, the jury was also given a verdict form on maliciously shooting at an occupied vehicle, which gave the jury a second option, actually two additional options, and this is at page 415 of the appendix. The two alternative options, one was to convict of maliciously shooting, the second is to convict of unlawfully shooting, and the third, of course, is to find him not guilty. And the jury convicted him of maliciously shooting an occupied vehicle, necessarily rejecting the factual premise, which he would need in order to get a conviction for manslaughter as opposed to second-degree murder. Opposing counsel has admitted here today that the difference between the charges on both counts is malice. Page 3.
Can they find malice for one offense and not the other under the theory of inconsistent verdicts?
If they had done so, the Commonwealth would not be able to challenge that on appeal. However, I don't think that opposing counsel, that Mr. Woods is allowed to argue on appeal that he was entitled to the right to jury nullification or to an inconsistent verdict. I would cite the court to Lilly versus Commonwealth and Greer versus Commonwealth for this discussion of inconsistent verdicts. I think it's Lilly specifically that talks about the fact that while courts recognize that these things do happen at times, no party is ever allowed to encourage or to infer that an inconsistent verdict would be permissible or should be encouraged. And essentially, that's what opposing counsel, without explicitly stating that, of course, is asking for, that he had a right to the jury having an opportunity to find inconsistent verdicts here, to find malice for maliciously shooting, but no malice for manslaughter. We would encourage the court not to allow that to be encouraged. here on appeal. So for that reason, under the principles enunciated in Turner, under the holding in Turner, the jury rejects the factual premise necessary for the lesser included finding. It is harmless error not to give that instruction, even assuming that it is error. As I've argued on brief, Commonwealth would assert that this was not error because of that undisputed physical evidence, the 10 total shots, all of which found their mark, 8 of which struck the defendant and the victim in the back of his body. I've attempted on brief to go through every version of the facts. I think we have at least 3 different versions coming from the defendant between his trial testimony and the 2 versions that he gave to 2 witnesses who testified on his behalf. All 3 of those versions, the question is whether a rational jury could have convicted him on that lesser included based on one of his 3 versions. If no rational jury could have convicted on the lesser included, then it's a matter of law under McClung versus Commonwealth, in which case no instruction is required. I would submit that no rational jury could find that as he was running away from this vehicle and shooting without aiming, he somehow managed to hit the victim with all 10 shots, the only 10 shots fired. I'd also submit that no rational jury could have possibly found that he became scared when he saw the victim moving his hand towards his gun and thus rapidly fired off 10 shots, 8 of which hit the victim in the body. In Vaughn versus Commonwealth, it was enough that one of the shots hit the victim in the back to disprove the defendant's testimony that he was merely shooting at the ground and trying to get the victim to retreat. The court found that he was unable to explain that one shot that hit the victim in the back of the body, and that one shot disproved his testimony, and as a result, he was not entitled to the jury instruction on the lesser included offense that he was seeking. In this case, we don't just have one shot in the back of the body, we have 8 shots in the back of the body. So I think that necessarily excludes any claim that he was still operating at a time when his mind was dethroned by his fear when he shot the victim 8 times in the back. And no matter how, whether
you would argue that the 8 times in the back point that you just made shows that it's not error to begin with.
Correct, Your Honor.
But also that it would be harmless error if it were error.
Correct, Your Honor. I think the 10 out of 10 disproves his claim that he was running away while firing the shots. I think 8 out of 10 in the back of the body disproves any claim that for this entire time period, he was operating out of fear. If there was any reason to believe that the victim may have still been coming at him while he was firing 10 shots and somehow managed to survive most of those shots and continue to come at him and attack the defendant, perhaps you could have a case where that many shots were fired and hit the victim in the front of the body, and the defendant could still claim that he was reasonably provoked by fear while firing all of those shots. When 8 of the 10 shots were fired in the back of the body, I don't think any rational fact finder could conclude that he was still operating under fear for all 8 of those shots. And also the fact that he was able to strike the defendant that accurately with 10 out of the 10 shots, I think it's McClung that talks about the fact that when you have a case where you've got shots that are scattered in a scattered pattern and maybe by the number of shots, a rational jury might conclude, well, this defendant's motor reflexes and his reasoning had been dethroned by this fear, this rage, just based on the pattern of the bullet holes and the kind of, I guess, just kind of aimless manner in which the shots were fired. In this particular case, he was deadly accurate with all 10 shots.
Can you say that, though, at the beginning of this, that there wasn't heat of passion involved in all of this or fear? Given that this man shows up after threatening him at his home with a gun on him, with his estranged girlfriend, who there appears to be a relationship between the victim and the girlfriend. So that's my first part of my question. The second part is, where does heat of passion then turn into malice?
I think before you get to the undisputed evidence in this case, there was the potential for heat of passion defense and a potential for heat of passion instruction based on the threats that had been made, based on the fact that the victim did carry a gun on his person, was known to carry a gun on his person. But by the way that the shooting unfolded, even under all 3 versions of the shooting, and by the undisputed evidence of 10 out of 10 shots hitting their mark and 8 out of the 10 shots in the back of the victim's body, I think it disproves any potential for heat of passion more than a scintilla supporting a heat of passion instruction. And so by that point, on this record, he was not entitled to that instruction. And I'm sorry, the second question, where does heat of passion turn into malice?
Malice.
Well, heat of passion requires reasonable provocation, and that results in dethroning the individual's reason, and that alone is the influence under which the defendant is operating. So it's, you need passion plus a dethronement of reason, and case law says if you don't have both, and if you don't have both at the same time, then you don't have a heat of passion defense. So even in this case, while there was the potential for an argument that he was angry or he was afraid, I think you still have to look at the question, is there more than a scintilla of evidence that he was operating under that influence? And that influence alone is what the case law says when he fired all of these shots. And that's what gets you to have to consider the undisputed physical evidence and the fact that he was shot 10 out of 10 times, which disproves the argument that he was running away from the vehicle, and the fact that 8 of the 10 shots were in the back of his body, which disproves the fact that even if he had been afraid at some earlier point, that he was still afraid while he was firing at least those 8 out of 10 shots which hit the victim in the back of his body. And again, from Vaughn, one shot is enough to disprove the defendant's claims, which he claims is entitled to a jury instruction on lesser included.
Thank you. So
counsel, jumping to the harmless error analysis, how do you respond to Mr. Slate's point about the jury giving on the low end of the sentence?
Right. So the jury did come down, on the low end of the sentence?
Yeah.
I think, and I'm not...
Is that something that the court considers in harmless error analysis?
I don't think opposing counsel cited any cases for that proposition in terms of something to be considered by the court. I'm not familiar with any off the top of my head. I would need to research the issue further. I would say that I think the range was somewhere like 5 to 20. I'm pulling this off the top of my head. And he got 12 years, so I'm not sure that it's not like he was given the mandatory minimum by the jury. The jury still went up. And so it's not as if the jury was straining to give him as little as they possibly could, and that you can necessarily infer they would have come down further on the second degree all the way to manslaughter. And secondly, I would submit to the court that argument really does nothing to undercut the argument that the jury rejected the factual premise that it would have had to have accepted in order to convict him of manslaughter. And that factual premise was that those shots were fired unlawfully but without malice. And they convicted him of maliciously shooting an occupied vehicle and rejected the opportunity to come down on that charge. That necessarily rendered any error harmless as a matter of law. Under Turner and under McPherson, is a case from this court, it's an unpublished case that I cited on brief, which engages in that type of analysis, looks at the jury's verdict on a separate charge, and concludes based on the fact that they were properly instructed on that charge and came to the verdict that they did, convicting him of possession of intent, conspiracy to distribute marijuana, rejecting an accommodation, lesser included, they necessarily would have rejected an accommodation, lesser included, on possession with intent to distribute the same marijuana, since the underlying facts are the same as to each. That's what the Commonwealth is encouraging the court to do on the harmless error analysis. There's additional precedent that I cited on page 28, footnote 27, I believe, in my brief. Unless the court has any further questions, I'll rest on the brief and ask the court to affirm.
Further questions?
Thank you,
Mr. Shanville. Mr. Slate, you have your rebuttal time.
And I'll first just correct the second-degree murder carried about 40 years, and with 12 years being given, that certainly on the lower end of that scale. I'll respond to the fact that counsel brings up the unlawful shooting instruction that was given and that the jury did not go with that argument or did not find that and found malice. I would suggest that I don't think any of us know what's in the minds of jurors. They simply could have been, and I think they certainly were, trying to come up with a collective amount of time and punishment for this individual, and I don't think looking at one specific charge and what they find in one charge is necessarily what they would have found on another charge. Moreover, in this case, and in all cases, heat of passion is determined by the provocation. And again, we have significant evidence of this individual Lamar Ward's reputation for violence, and that he always carried a gun with him. And that's the frame of mind that we have to work with in this case. That was Mr. Woods' state of mind at the time. And you know, whether it was 10 bullets, whether it was 3 bullets, whether it was 1 bullet, I think you have to look at it subjectively, and in this case, it's really hard to do that. We don't have a lot of eyewitnesses here, and I think we have, the two that we do have are both biased one way or another, and for that reason, again, we're not looking at whether he was found guilty of the second degree murder and finding malice. That is not the test. The test is whether there's a more than scintilla of evidence that could have led to a voluntary manslaughter finding. And I think it very clearly is in this case. Again, if we actually try to prevent these instructions, again, we're trampling on the Sixth Amendment more than anything. And again, case law up to this point has put in protections for that. Again, it's why the error looks at the light most favorable to the appellant, and also seems to be consistent in that frame. There are no further questions. I'll rest with that.
Further questions, Mr. Slate.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Slate. We will greet counsel.